From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Let's start on a cute note. Turns out there's a lot to be learned from the goo goo gaga sounds that babies make. We'll meet a doctor who studies infant speech development. Plus, we'll talk about what culture and race has to do with breastfeeding later this hour. First, though, let's talk about another part of the population that needs a lot of special care, the elderly. Last week, we heard about America's aging population and a massive study at Emory that looks at quality of life issues for seniors.
We're interested in what the participants think makes a difference in their lives. And by completing questionnaires periodically about their own medical history, their own current health, we can put these things together and find out what helps you age healthier.
Here are your first thoughts.
This is Janine Bradfield. I live in LaGrange, Georgia. I'm 82 years old. But let me tell you, every day I wake up, I'm excited. I mean, I'm living a wonderful life. I love this world. I love LaGrange. I wouldn't be anywhere else. I'm very, very active. Anyway, I just thought I'd call and tell you what a great world it is and how much fun I'm having at 82. And I expect to live to be 100 because I don't want to slow down.
We always love to know what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. On average, one out of every 68 children in America will have to deal with autism. And one of the first signs of an infant at risk of that disorder is the delay of this. Babbling is exactly what it sounds like. Indiscernible words of jumbled consonants and vowels strung together. It's adorable when babies do it. But it's also a pretty important stage of language development. A doctor at the Marcus Autism Center in Atlanta has collected the largest database of baby babbles. He hopes these recordings will provide clues about what causes autism. Dr. Gordon Ramsey is director of the Spoken Communication Laboratory at the Marcus Autism Center. It's part of Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and I spoke with Dr. Ramsey in April. All right, so let's talk about baby babble. When does it first begin in most children?
Sure. So babbling is actually a technical term, and it's a very specific stage of development that starts anywhere between 6 and 12 months. And when you talk about baby babble, it doesn't just mean any old sounds that the kids are making. It's really very specifically the moment at which kids begin to put together opening and closing movements of their mouths in sequence. When they do things like ba-ba-ba, da-da-da, okay, ga-ga-ga, okay. It's not just any old random sounds. And parents sometimes don't understand that babbling is a very specific stage kids go through. And it's really where the kids are driven biologically to start producing sounds in sequence. And those are really the first moments where babies begin to create syllables, which later provide the
structure. Putting together vowels and consonants.
Yeah.
This is the first stage, I think, that you're talking about called phonation?
Yeah. So there are five stages of speech development that are pretty well accepted by research scientists right now. And babbling is the fourth one, but there are others that go before it.
Okay. So let's start with the first one, which is called phonation. Let's hear it.
Here we go, little one. Epic fail.
How old is that baby there?
It's a two-month-old baby. And so when babies are born, they're not really in full control of their bodies, and they can't really control their tongues and their mouths properly. They're just making like squealing sounds or sounds with their larynxes. And at this stage, they're not really producing anything that's really volitional. They're just making reflexive sounds in response to the environment. In the beginning, you heard a cry. And at the end, there was kind of a long, drawn-out kind of squealy sound. It didn't have any meaning or structure to it. The baby is just pushing air out of its lungs, and that's naturally producing those sounds.
So as we start to connect some of this, these sounds to warning signs for autism, mm-hmm. at this age of a kid, do you have any idea whether the kid might develop autism or have vocal language development
Sure.
problems?
So at this stage, kids with autism or kids who go on to develop autism quite often exhibit atypical signs of cry and distress. This isn't necessarily specific to autism. Many neurodevelopmental disorders have atypical cry patterns at this age, but there are signs that some kids will show very early signs of atypical typical distress or response to distress in these cry patterns
all the way
on,
back at
all the way
months
back
old.
At 2 months old.
All right, let's go to this next stage. This one is known as gooing. It sounds like he's kind of making spit bubbles, he or she.
Yeah, and so at this point, babies' tongues are very big in their mouths, around about 3 to 4 months of age still, and they can't really produce fully fledged articulations with their tongues. And every time they make like a closure with their tongue, it just sounds like a g or k. And these are not really at all speech sounds. They're just babies randomly producing sounds with their mouths. And mothers reinforce them. And at this stage, a lot of those sounds sound like k or g or raspberries. And the mom there is interpreting that as gi or goo, because that's what it sounds like to an adult. That's why it's called gooing or cooing. But again, these are just random movements that later become speech sounds, but they're not actually speech sounds at this stage, and the baby doesn't know what speech is. But by the mom responding to those sounds, she's kind of reinforcing what she thinks those sounds sound like, and the baby uses that interaction, that feedback from mom, really to start to refine those sounds into things that later do become useful consonants and vowels.
What if a baby at a stage like that does not get feedback?
And that's the critical thing about autism, because the crucial scaffold for spoken language development in typically developing babies is social interaction with the caregiver. And autism, at its core, is a disorder of social engagement and social interaction. And anything that impacts social interaction early on is going to disrupt those processes of feedback that are so important for young children's language development. And so even though speech and language development is not a core feature of autism, one of the reasons that we think autism has a huge impact on speech and language development in young kids is because it disrupts that process of feedback between caregiver and child, which is really what's kind of streamlining and channeling the development of spoken language over those first 2 years of life. And so you heard there how the mom is immediately saying gee and goo to those really just spit bubble like sounds the baby is making. And that's really providing the information that baby needs to really refine those sounds and learn that they will evoke a response from mom and other people later on when it really does become speech.
So basically, you're a medical doctor telling me that when I make raspberries back to the cute baby on the train, I'm actually doing something that's necessary for its development.
Of course. I'm actually a PhD, a research scientist, not a medical doctor.
Oh, there you go.
But research tells us that really that process of contingent response, the fact that mom responds to baby and baby responds to mom, and there's a dance, a feedback between those two that really is creating that interaction and structuring that sound. That's really important for babies, because otherwise they wouldn't know that in particular languages you have particular sounds that you have to make, and in other languages you have other sounds. And a baby who doesn't get that feedback wouldn't know that a raspberry is not what we do in English, or a spit bubble is not what we do in English, versus k and p and t, and all of those other sounds that really are part of the full structure of English speech.
Okay, so let's start getting into a slightly more advanced stage. This is the third one, and it's called vocal play.
I know. I agree. Yeah. Oh. You want some more? Wow.
How old is this baby?
This is about a six-month-old baby. And the key thing about this stage is once babies begin to control their tongues more and they can control their breathing, so they can create sounds for longer periods of time, they can just play around a lot more with their tongues and their articulations, and they begin to really make lots of different dynamic changes in sound patterns that really can begin to form the basis of proto-conversations with the mom. And you heard there that even though the baby doesn't...
Proto-conversations.
Proto-conversations. Those are conversations. Those are interactions. Communicative interactions between the mom and the baby, but we can't call them conversations because they're not full speech. And at this stage, the baby still doesn't know exactly what speech is, but the baby knows that if it makes tons of different sounds, the mom is going to respond to those sounds and perhaps do things the baby wants to do. And so here, we have a whole melody. The baby has a melody of the voice. The baby's able to produce opening and closing sounds, movements of its mouth that really produce sounds that are more and more speech-like. We begin to hear things that sound like vowels and perhaps consonants. I could hear aya and da. There's a little da I heard at the beginning, even though the baby doesn't know it's a da. Okay, and again, by the mom responding to those different sounds and starting to recognize that those sequences of movements of the mouth that produce sounds are actually beginning to have communicative value for the baby and the caregiver, and that really provides the scaffold for a conversation before you really have the detailed structure of speech.
How much of it is a mimicry and how much is just trial and error?
That's a really great question. So early on, really, if you listen to the first clip we played, the mom and the baby were overlapping all the time. There was no turn-taking. As the baby gets older, the mom is really inserting herself into the conversation. When the baby was making those little spit bubble sounds, the gee and the goo, the mom was inserting herself into that conversation, but the baby wasn't really driving it. And so early on, it's the mom who initiates and structures the conversation. At this particular age, the baby starts to be able to start to control that turn-taking, and then that agreement of the baby and the mother to really respond alternately to each other begins to really emerge. And that's why it's a proto-conversation, because there's an interaction between the mom and the baby, and they're both able to begin to control and structure that interaction, even though the baby doesn't have full speech yet.
Is this, at what point, have we gotten to the point yet where if the baby is not reaching these milestones, because we're at 6 months,
yep,
there's cause for concern?
Sure. So by this time, a baby should be recognizing a caregiver's voice around about 3 months. They should be recognizing their name around about 6 to 8 months. And many kids with autism really are not showing those response patterns at this particular point in time. And so really, in some of our kids, we begin to see the fact they're not really responding vocally or to the voice of their caregivers in the way that we'd expect to see in typical development.
Well, let's move on to the fourth stage, and we're talking about stages of speech development in infants. And this one is, we finally have gotten to babbling.
Finally got to babbling.
So what makes this babbling?
The reason this is babbling is that for the first time we hear sounds that are clearly like consonants and vowels. We have a nya and an ah, okay? And most importantly, those sounds are being alternated in sequence. And this is what's actually called canonical babbling. And in this first stage, the
canonical babbling,
this is a term that was introduced in the 70s for this specific stage. It's a technical term. And it's the moment at which you have one particular consonant sound. Here it's nya, okay? This isn't actually a consonant sound in English. We don't say nya, nya, nya in English, okay, normally. But the baby has said nya and ah. And the baby says nya, ah, nya, 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 and alternates that opening and closing for the nya and the ah in sequence. And babies are driven to do this, and they do this with not just one sound, perhaps a few sounds. They usually start with bur or mer or per or the bilabial sounds, maybe with the lips. But the thing about canonical babbling is they're driven at this particular point in development to alternate those sounds, make nya, 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 ba, 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 da, 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 da. And they will go on and on and on doing this all day long sometimes. And once they get to this stage and they kind of get what babbling is and they're driven to do it and they start doing it, they will just do it all the time until they move on to the next stage, which is learning that they can actually change the sequence of sounds or have different sounds in different sequences.
Gordon Ramsay is the director of the Spoken Communication Laboratory at the Marcus Autism Center. It's part of Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. He's also an assistant professor of pediatrics at Emory University School of Medicine. This is On Second Thought. We'll talk now about one of the earliest, most personal decisions any new mother has to make, whether or not to breastfeed. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say breastfeeding rates in Georgia are lower than the national average. And nationally, breastfeeding by African American mothers trails white mothers by about 16%. That's a trend Kelly Scanlon monitors closely. She's an epidemiologist with the CDC.
While racial disparities in breastfeeding have narrowed over the last decade, the rates do continue to be lowest among African American infants compared to all other racial and ethnic groups that we monitor. So as a result, fewer African American infants and their mothers receive those health benefits of breastfeeding. And so this, for us, is a public health concern.
For more on this, let's revisit a conversation I had last year.
Andrea Serino is with Reaching Our Sisters Everywhere. That's a nonprofit group based in Georgia that focuses on supporting breastfeeding among African-American families. I also spoke with actress Anita Woodley. Her one-woman show, Mama Jugs, explores body image in the Black community and also looks at perceptions of breastfeeding. And we were joined by Betsy Collins. She's an obstetrician gynecologist at Emory University Hospital Midtown. That's been designated as a baby-friendly hospital. And Betsy began by explaining what that designation means.
Many women don't breastfeed and are not encouraged to breastfeed, don't learn about breastfeeding. And this program specifically provides time for education for the patients both prenatally during their prenatal visits and on labor and delivery and on postpartum to encourage and support breastfeeding. It's actually really hard to do. And moms need a lot of support and education, and that's what this program does.
Does it matter whether the person is insured or uninsured or underinsured, whether they get the benefits of programs like that?
It does depend. Certainly, it depends on who your doctor is. So some doctor's offices may not be participating in baby-friendly. Our office does. And then it also depends on where you deliver. Some hospitals that are participating in baby-friendly are in better neighborhoods or with higher socioeconomic status, and some are in urban and rural areas that have lots of patients that are in need and really need that education. So it really depends on who you're seeing and where you're going for your care. But the nice thing about the program is once you have it instituted, all patients receive the same education on labor and delivery and on postpartum.
So that brings me to you, Andrea, and to the reasons behind some of these racial disparities. Dr. Collins there just kind of hinted at one in terms of urban areas and socioeconomic status. But what are the other reasons why we see these pretty distinct disparities between races?
Oftentimes, African-American women aren't being talked to about breastfeeding prenatally, or in the hospitals as they deliver. And, you know, the wonderful thing about having the baby-friendly designation, as was just mentioned, is the fact that every patient that comes in receives education on breastfeeding now. And, you know, one of the things that Rose does is community transformer trainings, where we train women in the community to provide breastfeeding support who have in the past 5 years breastfed for at least 6 months. And in these trainings, we ask, you know, how many of you heard about breastfeeding, got any education about breastfeeding prenatally, or in the hospital? And to see that not many of their hands go up, you know, is one of the barriers that our women are facing in the community, is that they're not being talked to about breastfeeding. It's not a conversation, and it's assumed that because the rates are so low, they assume Black women don't breastfeed, and so the conversation sometimes isn't brought up. And it's great to see hospital policy changing to provide that education.
And you mentioned ROSE. That's actually just the acronym for Reaching Our Sisters Everywhere.
Yes.
Well, that brings us naturally to Anita then, because this is a conversation you're trying to spark and have been trying to spark, at least partially, with your performances, correct?
Yes.
So how does that conversation go? Is this an awkward conversation for African-American communities?
Well, I think it's a conversation that is actually happening, but it's nonverbal. And when it comes to my work and what I'm doing, it's like you bring it into theater. So all the things that aren't spoken, all of those things come across through the performances. And for me, you know, I learned from my great-grandmother, who was 95 years old at the time. And it was through the telling and the songs, things like that. So I think we've gotten away.
Sorry, Anita, your great-grandmother sang breastfeeding songs?
Yes, she sang songs that were from the 1800s from her mother. And that's how I learned how to breastfeed. I took the lactation class.
Can you sing one of those songs for us?
Yes, yes. Okay, I'll do it in her voice, which is always better.
There's breast milk in the breast jug. Say, gimme that breast. Say, latch him on. Say, rub it on his lip and pull it down. And he gon' snap it like a snapping turtle. Say, little pig, you want some corn? Say, wee, 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 mommy, give me that milk.
So, Andrea, was there at one point
judging by Anita's song from her great-grandmother, was there at one point a tradition of breastfeeding among African Americans that's been lost?
Oh, there definitely was. At one point in time, just in the U.S., breastfeeding rates were extremely high because that was the only thing to do until special formula was created for those that needed it. And then, you know, marketing got so well that breastfeeding rates went from almost, 98% to 22% in the United States. You know, so we are now working, through all the policies, through things that the CDC, Office on Women's Health, other organizations have collectively worked towards bringing these breastfeeding rates up. And so, yes, at one point in time, there was a strong history of breastfeeding across the board.
There wasn't anything else to eat.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
And I
go ahead, Anita.
Oh, I agree with that. For me, growing up, there were a lot of teenage and young moms, and Similac was the thing. It was like
Similac is a formula.
Yes, it's a formula. So with Similac, it was this thing where you thought you just Similac your kid. I thought that's what you do until my great-grandmother said, no, that's not how you make a good baby. And she told me, it's like planting a garden. You got to fertilize the soil. And then when it come out, it have good food. So you put it in and it come out. And then that's how the baby get healthy and be strong, you understand? And I was like, oh, but not Similac? She said, no. Where does a baby come out of a can?
Well, let me take this to you. Andrea, there is an issue, though, here of poverty versus wealth, because mm-hmm. a lot of mothers do have to go back to work of some kind after they've mm-hmm. given birth, and many employers don't have an option for them for either pumping or taking care of that while they're at work. So how do you help mothers overcome that?
Yes, breastfeeding issue in the workplace does go across the socioeconomic status, because even whether you're a salary or an hourly paid employee, you have to hope that the employer you're working with can help you by supporting you with a space, a reasonable space, whether it doesn't have to be a whole room dedicated. Federal law doesn't say you have to have a room, but at least a space with a door that they can go into, kind of put a sign on the door, let it be known that someone is utilizing that space, have a flat surface, and allow for that mom to be able to pump, during break times, her regular break times, and, the break times that a person that might be taking a smoke break, that same little break time also.
Anita, I wonder how these conversations go. I mean, you must have conversations with people about this. And there are so many sort of emotionally charged issues, not just the one we discussed before about being judged for choosing not to breastfeed, but also are you breastfeeding your kid for too long? Why is your 3-year-old still breastfeeding? Are you breastfeeding them for too short? And this ends up becoming a really, again, very, very emotional personal issue. How do these conversations go for you?
Well, the conversations, they're really interesting, especially when it comes to the fathers, because they don't get it. And a lot of the women don't, because our bodies have been so sexualized. And especially at that age, all you're thinking about is, especially with the moms I grew up with that were younger, my breasts are for, attracting people or for looking good. And so when you take the sexualization out of it and you see that light bulb come on, for instance, the North Carolina Council of Churches had me do mama jugs for churches to show them to not only be breastfeeding friendly and put them in a room, but to let them breastfeed right there in the pew if the moment happens. And it's okay. So it's not, as my great grandma would say, it ain't nasty. It's not nasty. It's life. I mean, you should be applauding someone that's breastfeeding. And just having that conversation for people and letting them know it's okay to do it. You're doing the good things. And even if you can't do it, that's all right too. But you can support other folks to let them know, like building that community mm-hmm. to say breastfeeding is okay and it's encouraged and you're doing something for your baby that's substantial and really breaking it down to them just how great this is going to be for their child and for them, that bonding experience. I did it with my son that's 12, and my husband was the one to latch my son on first because he paid attention in the classes and listened to great-grandma's songs. I was distraught after pushing that 5 pounds out. And my husband came right in and came behind me, put him in a football hole. I was right in the hospital bed, and that's how he latched on. And it's just wonderful. We need to involve the men as well.
Betsy Collins, I mean, obviously you work in Atlanta. You must get a huge diversity of women coming in who are expecting.
Absolutely.
Have you changed minds for people who come in expecting not to breastfeed and then they end up doing it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in regards to some of the things that were said by the other guests, you know, there's a whole, you know, a lot of moms have a lot of concerns in terms of what happens when I go back to work, what
right.
happens when I get home and dad wants to feed the baby or grandma wants to feed the baby, or I have pressure from other family members to use formula. And you have to just support the mom where she is. And oftentimes I'll just remind moms, any breastfeeding is good. Even if you feed the baby when you get home from work and first thing in the morning or in the middle of the night, you know, meeting people where they're at, we have recommendations, and then we also have real life. And I try to just remind moms, do what you can, because I think people have such high expectations for themselves and they feel like if they can't meet those 100% that they're a failure and that they have to quit. And I think just reminding them that doing it even as much as they can, whatever, meet them where they are, that's okay. And I think that that's very reassuring for a lot of moms. I see all kinds of moms with all kinds of jobs, you know, stay-at-home moms, moms that are working hourly work, moms that are baggage handlers, you name it. And sometimes they just need that little bit of understanding to realize that, you know, they too can do it. It just might be on their terms sometimes.
That was Betsy Collins from Emory University Hospital Midtown, Andrea Serrano with the group Reaching Our Sisters Everywhere, and Anita Woodley, whose one-woman show, Mama Jugs, explores body image in the Black community. The decision to breastfeed is a highly personal one, but so is the decision to become pregnant. More women are waiting later in life to have children, and that's where fertility treatment can be a valuable resource. But research by the Fertility Center at New York University finds 80% of women who froze their eggs during a 6-year period were white, 4% were Black. Atlanta fertility specialist Desiree McCarthy-Keith says it's time for that to change.
Did you know that ovaries contain 6 to 7 million developing eggs before birth? By the time a baby girl enters the world, her egg count has dropped to around 1 million. From birth on, she will have a steady decline in her egg supply until menopause, at which point her egg supply is exhausted and her fertility ends. This is a natural process for all women. At the same time that their eggs are ticking away, many women are choosing to put off having children. For some women, family building takes a back seat to the pursuit of educational, career, or personal goals. For others, unfortunate circumstances like a sudden cancer diagnosis may force them to involuntarily delay their fertility. And then there are women who are just not ready to become pregnant. Some may still be waiting for Mr. Right, while others may wish to maintain their child-free lifestyle a little longer. Women who find themselves in any of these life circumstances should consider freezing their eggs. We're making progress in this area, but I hope to see more women taking advantage of this technology in the future. Many women now benefit from employer-offered insurance benefits, which cover egg freezing. Still, I personally see fewer women in my practice who choose to freeze their eggs for social reasons. When it comes to Black women, I've observed even fewer coming in for elective egg freezing. When you look at the field of reproductive medicine as a whole, Black women are often underrepresented among all women seeking fertility treatment. The reasons for the disparity are complex and include culture, stigma, awareness, and access. Early fertility awareness campaigns were geared toward middle-class white women, so many Black women have not historically considered themselves in the demographic of fertility patients. Deep-rooted stereotypes that misrepresent Black women as hyperfertile and more in need of birth control than fertility treatment unfortunately still exist. And many Black women shun fertility treatments among themselves as something we don't do. It's time for our thinking to change. It's time to remove the stigma of fertility treatment and to separate fertility from status and self-esteem. I have many courageous patients who boldly enter my office to start the process. I applaud them for taking control of their fertility, and I want to see more women doing the same. As a fertility specialist of color, I advocate for the inclusion of minority women in every aspect of fertility preservation and treatment. I encourage my colleagues to expand their idea of what an infertility patient looks like. I encourage Black women to talk with their doctors about fertility testing and treatment, even if they have to start the conversation themselves. I'm proud to be a relatable figure for Black women who are interested in fertility treatment. I'm hopeful that when they look at me, they see themselves.
That was Desiree McCarthy Keith. She's a fertility specialist based in Atlanta. This is On Second Thought. Georgia native Karen Slaughter is the author of several international bestsellers. Her latest book, Pretty Girls, is about two women whose teenage sister vanished without a trace. The paperback edition of that book came out in April. I spoke with Karen Slaughter shortly after the release of her latest book. She admits it's dark, but Karen says there is light as well. Here's some of our no-spoilers conversation.
Well, you know, I'm the youngest of three girls, and most of my stories when I was a little girl were about my sisters disappearing or being murdered or getting in trouble, and then my parents loved me the best, which, you know, probably they did love me best anyway. So it was just sort of me writing that relationship. And in the book, Julia, the oldest sister, when she's 19 years old, she's a college student at UGA, and she just disappears. They have no idea what happened to her. And I wanted to explore what would happen to a family broken apart by a crime like that. So this was kind of my way to exorcise those demons.
Did your family, your sisters, or your parents read those stories you wrote about your sisters disappearing?
They did. And actually, I think today I'd probably be put on Ritalin or something, but... Actually, my teachers were very supportive, and they focused me into creative writing and really nurtured that weirdness in me. My best advice came from my ninth grade teacher, though, because she said, you can't kill everyone in your stories. You have to have some balance.
Wait, you are trying to kill all the people.
Exactly.
You were a young George R. R. Martin.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. My whole Red Wedding was like my whole oeuvre before I hit the ninth grade. But, you know, I do think that was an important lesson for me. You do have to balance some of that darkness with lightness. And in Pretty Girls, I use that relationship between the two remaining sisters and the family. And, you know, I love reading thrillers. It's my passion. And I'm never interested in that unrelenting darkness. So I always think about one of my favorite short stories by a good Georgia native, Flannery O'Connor, where she's talking about a serial killer named the Misfit, and a good man is hard to find.
Good man is hard to find.
And I love that line where the serial killer says about the grandmother that she would have been a good woman if someone had killed her every single day of her life. You know, and that's the kind of, I think, Southern humor and lightness that balances out some of that more dark material.
Why do you like reading thrillers? You know, oftentimes I'll talk to authors who write a certain genre of book, but that's not what they read in their off time.
Gosh, you know, I've heard people do that, and I understand it on some level because I'm lucky that a lot of thriller writers are my friends, and I don't want to read their book and think, oh, you know, I hate this, or I know Lee Child, and so sometimes
wrote a great blurb for your
book.
Yeah,
he did, yeah. But sometimes I'll hear his voice instead of my voice for Jack Reacher, and I can understand that, but I mean... The thing that made me want to write thrillers and work on the puzzle of writing a mystery novel, I mean, the main thing that really put me on that road was reading Encyclopedia Brown or Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys, or, you know, I did take a detour into V.C. Andrews and all that as a teenager.
Flowers like, in the Attic.
Exactly,
yeah.
Or Lace.
Yes.
But, you know, once I got past all that drivel, I was back into reading thrillers. Sarah Paretsky, Sue Grafton, you know, so these were the types of books that made me want to really be a writer.
What does it take to be a really good thriller writer? I mean, when you're reading somebody else's work, what books do you, what do you read that makes you throw the book down in disgust? And what do you read where you say, wow, this is good?
Well, you know, primarily, I'll start with the good, the language in some of these. A friend of mine, Denise Mina, she's a Scottish crime writer. She's amazing, and the language in her books is so impeccable. I remember the last line I read of hers that just made me green with envy. She's talking about a character's watching the waves and describes the cresting waves like when you slice the top of a bag of sugar. And, I mean, that was just so beautiful, and I hated her so much at that point. You know, it actually took me out of the book because I was like, I can't believe how great this is. So that's what excites me. What I hate is what everybody who reads thrillers hates, is when it doesn't make sense, you know, or you think, you know, you're 10 pages away and you think, gosh, the writer just figured this out. And suddenly there's like a pubic hair that's found and they pick it up and put it under a microscope and someone says he was a left-handed killer. He hated his mother, you know, and I hate that. I really, the only person I think that I can think of off the top of my head that can really do forensics well is Jeff Deaver. And that's because generally it's not the big solve is through a microscope, you know. So I like when the puzzle is there and it and they play fair with me and I can figure it out along the way. And when I get to the end, it's like, aha, instead of what the heck.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Karen Slaughter. She's an Atlanta native and an author of a number of bestsellers. Her latest is called Pretty Girls, and it's now out in paperback. I wonder if it ever gave you pause, because you're such a strong writer and the writing has such integrity just as writing. And you worried you would not get the respect that, say, if you were writing adult fiction, right, that people think about. The reason I ask this is because I think about Stephen King, who's a brilliant, just a writer. And if you were writing anything other than horror, he might be taken differently in a scholarly sense. Did you ever give that any thought?
The genre doesn't matter so much to me. I mean, I didn't go into the genre thinking, oh, my God, people aren't going to take me seriously. I kind of knew that as a thriller reader and as someone who studied Renaissance poetry in college, but still people couldn't believe if I had a Stephen King paperback, you know, so something must be wrong with me. I'm not a serious literature person. But, you know, honestly, I mean, he's a perfect example. His characters are amazing. I would hold up Dolores Claiborne to any character, Faulkner, Hemingway, any of those guys. I mean, just an amazing character. And not least of all because it's somebody who's actually interested in writing about a well-developed woman. But for me, you know, I'm not really concerned so much with a genre. I do wish that thrillers were taken seriously, but we sell a heck of a lot. So it's kind of weird to complain that we're the best-selling genre, you know. And for me, I just think it's important to tell a story. And I would defy you to mention any book that has endured in the American canon that doesn't have some sort of crime or murder. I mean, Gone with the Wind, there is an extremely brutal and violent murder.
There is.
You know, when we watch it in the South on at the Fox, everybody hisses when the Yankee comes up into Tara, and there's Scarlett there, and she has her gun, and he's going through her mom's sewing box, and she shoots him in the face. And in the book, the way she describes the hole in his face, the blood trickling across
gory.
The floor, and she actually says Scarlett wants to dance. She's barefoot. She wants to dance in his still warm blood. I mean, that's a thriller passage. So if that's a thriller, then I think I'm in good company.
But tell me a little bit about getting into the minds. I find it fascinating that people often ask crime writers, male crime writers, wow, you wrote a great female character. How did you get into the mind of the female? But they never ask females, wow, you wrote a great male character. How did you get into the mind of the male? But I find myself sometimes thinking, and not necessarily in this book, but in some of your other books, if there is anything that you do differently when you're writing a male character, because you do write them so well and so authentically.
Well, thank you. You know, I'll make a very blanket statement, because obviously this doesn't apply to men and women universally. But when I'm writing Will Trent, for instance, he's much more of a let's not talk about the problem, let's solve the problem, or pretend it's not even there. And I think a lot of men have that in them, you know.
Problem solvers.
Right. They want to solve that problem. And what's the point of talking about it endlessly? And a lot of women feel like they need to talk it out. And I'm kind of a mixture of those two things, depending on the problem. That's why I'm saying it's a blanket statement. And I think Will is too. You know, sometimes he wants to talk it out more, and usually he's talking to Faith, his partner. And I think at work, it's easier for him to talk things out with Faith than it is at home to talk things out with Sarah. Because with Sarah, he's more like, you know, kind of afraid to talk about how he feels about something because that might be a weakness and she might not be attracted to him anymore. And, you know, all that gets caught up in there. So those are the things I keep in mind. And I wrote a character, Jeffrey Tolliver, in my earlier books.
Sheriff.
And he was more of a touchy-feely kind of guy. But then I had him do things like beat up suspects and get in car accidents and shoot people and to kind of balance it out to make him manly. So Will was a response to that, thinking, well, let me do a different kind of guy character because there are a lot of different guys out there.
There's also, I mean, when we're speaking about authenticity, there's also clearly a great deal of authenticity in the places of your books. These are areas that you know very, very well, not just for Will Trent, but Grant County, and then some of those that take place. This book, Pretty Girls, well, it kind of, they drive a lot of different places. They kind of span a certain area of the state. And I wonder, have you ever wanted to write about another location, or is there something about really, really knowing a place intimately that helps you as a writer?
Well, yeah, I think it does help to know. You know, if you look at Bradbury, when he's writing about Mars.
Ray Bradbury, science fiction
writer. Ray Bradbury.
Writer.
He's really writing about his hometown, right? And I think that we...
And Stephen King writing about Maine.
Exactly, yeah. So I really, when I started out, I made a conscious choice to write about Atlanta. And so this was, well, when I wrote this book 18 years ago, so I was 12, basically. But it was a really kind of radical choice not to set it in Los Angeles or New York or some crimey place like that at the time. Nobody was really writing about Atlanta in a realistic criminal kind of way. So it was a choice on my part. And instead of writing about a big town, I wanted to write about a small town because that's what I grew up in. I grew up in Jonesboro, Georgia, which is a lot like Grant County. You know, we had the junior college. That was our big claim to fame. And so I wanted to really kind of write what I know. But I think you should also write what you want to know. And I wanted to know more about crime. And, of course, I was in Jonesboro when the Atlanta child murders were going on. And so I remember very distinctively, you know, that time before the murders, before children were being targeted, before it was on the news all the time, before people were terrified. And then after, I wasn't allowed to go outside without my parents knowing where I was. And, you know, before that, literally, we would be locked out of the house in the summer because my mother couldn't stand us underfoot. And she's like, go outside and play. And if you get thirsty, there's the hose. And if you have to go to the bathroom, there's the woods. After that, I mean, our lives totally changed. It was just a really transformative time because of this crime occurring. And we know how far Jonesboro is from Atlanta, you know, especially then. I mean, 45 minutes was an eternity. Jonesboro was considered a very small town. But it did terrify us, and it changed how our community was. And so that's what I really wanted to write about. And so that's why I picked a small town.
Does crime still scare you? Do criminals still scare you?
Crime bothers me. Mass shootings bother me that generally, statistically, during these mass shootings, the first victim is a woman. It bothers me we don't talk about that. It bothers me we don't talk about the violence against women, that we'll talk about the 8% of cases where a woman falsely accuses someone of rape instead of the 92% where they don't. You know, that kind of thing bothers me, that we don't really look at crime for what it is and who it affects, that we don't look at the scourge of, you know, who we have imprisoned. Lives we've ruined with the industrial prison complex. That bothers me. I think if you worried about being a victim of crime, you'd never leave the house. So I try not to think about that. I try instead to think about we need to change things as opposed to taking a posture of we need to hide under the covers all the time.
Before we go, my last question for you would be the kind of crime that you're talking about, the crime that annoys you, is not the crime generally that would be a good thriller. Do you know what I mean? Like, you need a diabolical mind,
right?
That's the and the criminal's part in order to be a really good thriller. How is it even possible to turn that kind of crime into a good novel?
I think it is. You know, I mentioned Denise Mina. She's really good at talking about the crimes that are more realistic. I mean, let's face it. The crime I write about in Pretty Girls actually happens. It's based on something that was shared with me through a contact in law enforcement.
Which is awful.
Which is awful. But Denise writes about, and you know, Lisa Gardner does this sometimes too, Tess Gerritsen. Most criminals are really stupid. Or they have made really bad choices, and they keep making bad choices after bad choice after bad choice, and they keep getting in trouble, and they keep digging and digging, trying to get out of that hole, and that's how they end up in trouble. And many of them, it's economic. You know, here in Georgia, we've privatized our parole system. So if you get out on parole and you can't afford to pay for this sudden drug testing that the parole company throws on you, even though it's not court mandated, you can end up back in jail. I mean, Georgia started out as a debtor's colony, and now we're going right back to imprisoning poor people like we're a debtor's colony again. So, you know, that kind of thing, while it's horrible, I couldn't really write a book about it. I have to pick the really big crimes, but I think there are ways and avenues within the story to mention this sort of thing. Because, like in my next book, which is out in September, called The Kept Woman, has Will Trent in it. I have Faith, his partner, has worked the Atlanta cheating scandal, right? The Atlanta Public Schools American, cheating scandal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's talking about this one school, and she mentions that if this had been, so this is like a 99.5% minority school, right? And she says, of course, if this had been a white school, the cheating never would have happened and no one would have paid attention. You know, it just would not be an issue. And that's the kind of thing I like to talk about in my books, is to slip in these little social issues that might make people think, but then I have to write a nice, juicy thriller for them to actually want to read the story.
Karen Slaughter is an Atlanta crime author. Her new book, Pretty Girls, is now available in paperback. And that's our show for today, but who is your crime writer of choice? Who writes the best thriller, as far as you're concerned? Is it Scott Pratt, maybe? Melinda Lee? Or an old classic like Agatha Christie? Who writes the best crime fiction? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk or post a response on Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.